Right. So, my name is Julian Chambliss. It's June 23rd. I'm speaking with Dr. Walter Greeson of Monmouth University as part of Voice of the Black Imaginary Afrofuturist Oral History Archive. Walter, can you say your name and your title and tell us, your little short bio?
Wow. Okay. Let's see. Walter David Greeson. I am the associate professor and chair of the Department of Educational Counseling and Leadership. I am also a dean emeritus of the Honor School at Monmouth University in West Long Branch, New Jersey. Biographically, I was born and raised in New Jersey. Did my education undergraduate at Villanova, my PhD at Temple. I've published written or edited 6 books and contributed to 2 more, having to do with the Black speculative arts movement and broader issues of architecture and urban planning.
Okay. And the reason I'm talking to you for this sort of oral history is to talk a little bit about your recent exhibition this last year at Monmouth University. It's worth noting for the listener that one of the books that you co-edited was City to Imagine, which I co-edited with you.
Yes, sir.
Which sort of looked at African-American media and culture throughout time and history. So it very much sort of situated in that sort of Afrofuturist Black speculative imagination realm. It's in there that I think we sort of talked a lot about this idea of the Tuskegee universe, which is a concept that I think at one point I was like, we should call it the Washingtonian universe or something like that. And then it's like, no, we can't do that. People don't think we were talking about George Washington, so we just call it the Tuskegee universe. And that was really a way to sort of think about black intellectual activity in the post-Reconstruction era. I know that you thought and written about urban design, urban planning, and for your exhibit, you were sort of situating a kind of introduction to Afrofuturism for your campus. So can you tell us a little bit about the exhibit, how it came to be, and what were some of the goals that you had for that exhibit as a curator?
Yes, thank you. It's one of the great things in my life to enjoy and build this work together with you and with so many other partners now. It has really come center stage for a number of reasons. The Afrofuturist Design exhibit was a direct outgrowth of the connection you made between myself and John Jennings. And I want to say this is back in like 2014, 2015, after your work in Rollins College in Florida. And there was an exhibit there on the Black figure in the European imaginary and those projects. John had me come out to Loyola Marymount to participate in an Astro Blackness conference in California. And he and I just vibed about art and graphic design and the history of comics, Black figures. I think this is before his first Eisner win with and the way that his graphic novels have unfolded, even before Black of the Ink came out with Francis Gateward. And so that foundation introduced me to so many extraordinary people. Got to be a part of Ruha Benjamin's Ferguson is the Future event for Black speculative writers at Princeton, along with Rinaldo Anderson and Alondra Nelson and just a spectacular array of Black writers and artists. All of that work fueled our conversations, my determination to get something like Cities Imagined done. And so Afrofuturist Design was me bringing all of that back home, bringing that back to the library at my home institution, which is a place that had been really designed and kind of executed to carry out very traditional visions of the white American imaginary. And so there are a lot of symbols and a lot of policies on campus that marginalize people of African descent and indigenous people. And so Kurt Wagner is a librarian, university librarian, and he and I had become very close during my time as dean of the honor school. And so in talking with him, I would see the exhibits that would come through about colonial life in New Jersey or about Bruce Springsteen and folk tradition. And I was like, listen, when you get a minute, if there's a chance I can get into the calendar, I'd love to have an exhibit here in the library about African Americans and their visions of the world, both their past and their present and their future. And that turned out it could fit right in after our trip to the NSASA conference in New Zealand. And so through that summer and doing a lot of the virtual work on preserving and exploring historic Black spaces, we got to pull together books out of the library, art from John Jennings, Michelle Mulopola, Stanford Carpenter. Toni Morrison had passed away that summer, and so we wanted to feature a lot of her work in that tradition. And it was just tremendous to have it all come together. And that first weekend, you were our keynote speaker, talking about the kinds of research and work we've been doing. And so Afrofuturist Design also, of course, builds off of the ridiculous amount of work I've done around the Wakanda syllabus that showed up in the Black Panther movie. And so that whole moment really came back to West Long Branch in a way that now has really manifested just last week in the renaming of the Woodrow Wilson main building as the Great Hall. And that effort to take Black voices seriously and Black intelligence, Black intellect seriously, it's just an unbelievable moment that all of these influences come together and started to really give us the chance to reimagine the world we occupy and what we can do next.
Okay. And you mentioned that a lot of work that you've done. You worked on the Wakanda syllabus. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So it's so hard. These last several years have been just an absolute whirlwind, but I think in my life, it's a top two or three to this point moment, in that in 2016, the Marvel Cinematic Universe had produced Captain America Winter Soldier. And in that film, they introduced the Black Panther to the world and brought this character out of the comic book pages. And I had gone back to like 99, 2000, talking with Christopher Priest and Reginald Hudlin, sometimes on a daily basis, about things they were doing in the comics. In 2003, I was teaching a race and media class at Drexel, and reached out and let Marvel know about it. They published the letter that I wrote to them. They said, continue to do this work. They had the joking term, they make you an ambassador to Wakanda. And so it was this kind of nice moment to say, yes, please, you know, as you bring students and you bring other educators into the circle, this is helping us grow the influence. I think the turning point for me was like 2006, 2007, when on Hudlin's public forum, there were a group of us, a lot of former Milestone creators and editors, talking about if there was a Black Panther movie one day, how would we design it? How would we engage in this speculation about what it should be like? And it was a thread on their public forum called Culture of Wakanda. And I started it off just by spelling out what I knew. It was like the core of, if you wrote a Bible about the fictional Wakanda, what would it be? What would it involve? And so it was little pieces from the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It was innovative details that Priest and Hudlin had brought in since the late 90s. And that thread really took off. I think I looked at it a year or two ago. It had over 50,000 uses. There were all kinds of ways where people like Al Ewing were coming on board and making reference to it and connecting it to the stories they were writing for Marvel Comics. And so the Culture of Wakanda thread was the initial seed of the Wakanda syllabus. And then after the 2016 film was successful, I knew eventually there was going to be a Black Panther movie. And so I spent 6-8 months pulling together all of the resources from the Astro Blackness and from the Planet Deep South events, finding everybody I could that I knew has written something in Black speculative arts, and putting them into different sections, into film or television or internet or novels or nonfiction, and just made it a first stop for folks who wanted to understand the kind of lexicon that would eventually show up in the film. And then with the excitement about the film at the end of 2017, a lot of folks tapped into it. It was published by the African American Intellectual History Society under their award-winning blog. They won a major prize.
Yeah,
Black Perspectives. And led to a bunch of series that you and I worked on about race and comics that I think folks have to tap into to get a sense of how rich this terrain is. There were a series on Luke Cage, series on Black Panther, general takes on the way African influences show up in comics. Just so much insightful work that came out of those series of essays. And so the film, I think we were hopeful for it to do well in January of 2018. You and I were at the Schomburg for the preview screening. I'm still envious that you got to hang out with some pretty amazing actors and actresses in the course of that night.
Right. So but, the preview event at the Schomburg is part of the Black Comics event at the Schomburg. They didn't actually show the film, but one of the Dora Milaje actresses was there. Florence.
Kasumba.
Yeah, and Jonathan Gales, who is a really pivotal figure because his documentary, White Scripts, Black Superman, you know, and John James, of course, they were some of the first people that set up the Schomburg Black Comic event. And I did get to go to the after party, which was way more complicated than you would think into an after party is. It was New York City, so I guess I should be like, well, yeah, that's what happened. New York, and then like the cast of the Luke Cage showed up, and we got to hang out.
That photo with Simone Missick is pretty legendary, man.
Yeah, that's what happens when you you're in the beating heart of media empire that is New York City. Right? she was very nice, actually. Like, she was super nice, and we were all like, "Wait, that's Cockroach from." Like, I was like, "Hey, well, that's the whole cast. Who was married to Simone? Dwayne.
Yes.
Married to Simone." I like to point that out right away. But
they are a beautiful couple.
Yeah, they're very, very, very nice couple. So there's a long line of work that you're doing related to that, and I think it's worthwhile to understand that some of your work is sort of filtered around place in a way that's really meaningful. So you have a book, Suburban Erasure, that sort of deals with development or erasure in New Jersey, and that sort of like sets up a kind of intellectual history that corresponds to a kind of actual urban development history that's also a part of this Afrofuturist design, right? This question of intellectual recovery. Can you talk a little bit about that arc in the work and how it comes together with some of these speculative pieces that are interesting to you?
Yeah, so that's a really difficult point because so much of my foundation in urban history, when I came to do this project about New Jersey, it was out of a family emergency. I had to care for my parents and start to redesign the trajectory of my dissertation. And so instead of comparing racial violence in the US and South Africa, to be around my family, I had to look at how the community around us had changed. And so it was a small Black rural working class village, unpaved roads, very little electricity. Frequently, my neighbors didn't have running water. And when I came back to do the project, there was just massive suburbanization, a new regional mall, highway expansions, all the roads were paved, traffic lights were everywhere. Population density had surged. And so that's what was the provocation for suburban erasure, was instead of looking at suburbs as destinations of white flight, it was saying, where did the flight go to when it left the city? And what happened to the Black people on the rural fringes as a result of this white in-migration? And so it flips the traditional standard of looking at migration into cities and then ethnic competition and then ultimately the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s and white flight out of places like Newark. It starts from the outside. It starts from places like Asbury Park and Freehold and these smaller Black communities that did not have same kind of historical textual record to draw on. And so it took forever. It took 9 years to pull together all the kind of fragmentary resources to stitch together an analysis. But what I've run into among urban historians is a very kind of pervasive assumption is that, oh, well, it's very difficult, even with gentrification and displacement, nothing is ever really erased. Nothing is ever really lost. And there's this just massive privilege embodied in that, especially as I get into and I talk about these traditions out of social and cultural history, that, you know, there are places that don't have written records. And when you think about the history of indigenous people, especially in the U.S., the ways that their stories are just literally wiped off the map and suppressed through the processes of settler colonialism, they're very similar to the ways histories of slavery and segregation are also just wiped away and taken off of the landscape. So those are the tensions that then, when I started to write this series of teaching resources with various book co-editors, you most prominently, that was me pointing towards how to do the reclamation and find new resources and bring new students into these stories so that we get a more complete picture, so that we hear from more women and more indigenous people, more people of African descent, not just in the United States or in the UK or Canada, but really around the world. And so that takes me to the most recent stuff that comes out of Afrofuturist design, is this idea of the Black Brain Belt on the coast of New Jersey, places like Red Bank, Asbury Park, and Long Branch, where a group of Black technicians and engineers coming out of segregated institutions in the 30s and 40s took over jobs, filing patents and creating radio, television, telecommunications technology at Fort Monmouth in Eatontown, New Jersey. And it was thousands of families all tied into very technical skills that essentially built the infrastructure for things like this that we're talking on a call and recording information. And I guess most notably, I think of, you know, folks who worked on voice recognition software. This was all pioneered by African-American scientists and technicians. And so these folks were my mentors when I was a very small child. They're the ones who brought me for the first time onto Monmouth University's campus to learn computer science, to learn advanced mathematics before I'd even entered junior high school. And so it was very real to me the way we imagined what Wakanda was, an advanced Black society inventing cutting-edge technologies that like no one had ever seen before. Like, the people teaching me were those people. And so as I started to really uncover what was being erased, it is this Black brain belt of Black professionals, Black middle-class families that did not conform to the stereotypes or even the historical record of what we saw in a Brooklyn or Harlem or South Side of Chicago, in Watts or Compton outside of Los Angeles. And so that made me then do more work with you in particular around the Zora Neale Hurston Festival in Eatonville and these Black independent communities that were forming throughout the South after the abolition of slavery. And how do we reclaim those stories? And how do we recognize the kind of genius that Zora Neale Hurston highlighted for us? But how did this also exist throughout the Gulf Coast and throughout the kind of rural, quote unquote, South? Place like Birmingham as an urban center needs much more study. Really pleased that we just see this new book on Hattiesburg, Mississippi, that Stuckey put together, that Black community history start to show us a history of excellence and struggle that gets ignored and needs further excavation. And now we're doing even more across the plains and across the Great Lakes region. to see that the impact of globalization and deindustrialization has been this massive threat to what made Black innovation, Black technical engagement, and stable lifestyles through the middle of the 20th century really fall apart. And so that's what I'm trying to do in the years ahead, is to take the model and then further document the success of the Black Brain Belt up through the early 1980s, but then more globally, come up with visualizations and infographics, economic analyses of the success of Black regional communities. I look at a book on the Triangle Research Center in North Carolina that Alex Cummings has put together, and her work is just so good to help us understand institutional investment and its impact. But this applies to Black communities too. And so there are these technical centers like the Black Brain Belt that we need more people to come and study. We need people to engage with. And so I'm hoping to kind of carry, you know, what I've done so far forward in those ways.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sort of laying that out, because I do see that as part of this sort of Black future industry, which is a kind of alternative way of thinking about a more traditional future industry that we associate with speculative practice. You know, I think that there's a lot to your narrative here, and I really appreciate you taking the time to sort of like frame things so clearly, both in terms of the exhibit, but also in terms of the broader thinking pathway sort of got you to that.
If I could interject just one real quick example, because of the change of the Great Hall's name at Monmouth, one of the corollaries to that that doesn't get mentioned enough is that Julian Abel is one of the early prominent Black architects in the 20th century, and he actually designed the interior of the building. And it is like a metaphor that we intentionally took the name of a kind of divisive and segregationist president, someone committed to white supremacy, and put his name on the building when he had virtually no connection to it. When someone like Julian Abel, who literally built the space and made it something so gorgeous, a monument to what education can be, we've only started to kind of acknowledge the work that he did there. And so that piece, where we're seeing the discussion around what we name things and how we actually grapple with the subtleties of the history, the complexities of the history, you caught me at a really good time. I'm on fire about all that right this minute.
Right, and I think that's a perfect, that's perfectly stopped. I mean, hopefully we'll follow up with some more conversation about the further development of this sort of Black Brain Belt and sort of economic analysis around Black spaces that you're doing. But I thank you for talking to me, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
You are my best colleague. You know this.